Mammoth!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And while you're there, why not leave a review on iTunes? You don't even need to tell the truth. No one's going to know. So here's the thing. I want to know how to spot a good liar. No, scratch that. I want to be a good liar. I want to be the sort of person who can spin a tale, win over any room, and leave people believing the bullshit that I've dumped down for them. The problem is, where do you learn that type of information? After all, there are dozens and dozens of books on how to lie and how to spot liars. But the problem is, they're written by people who are really good at doing just that. So how do you separate the fact from the fiction? How do you spot the good liars from the bad? And how do you find the perfect book on deception? On this week's episode of Scammapalooza, I'm joined by New York mentalist and mind reader Vinny DiPonto as we explore five of his favorite books on the art of the lie. At least, that's what he tells me. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. This is the, I was going to call it the Liars Book Club, Vinny, but I've just decided we should call it the Bullshitters Book Club.
I think that's perfect.
Yeah. Excellent. Great. So obviously, both you and I share a love of books about lying and deception. And today we're just going to go through some of our favorites. Before we get into it properly, what's drawn you to this particular area? Because there's a huge number of books out there on this subject, on lies and deception. What's drawn you to it?
So I was just drawn to the actual psychology and philosophy of deception. And it actually started all with On the Decay and the Art of Lying, the Mark Twain essay. I don't know why I just had a southern drawl when I said that. But that's,
anything related to Mark Twain requires a southern drawl.
Yeah, I think so. So that's kind of what it started. It just snowballed from there. I just became obsessed with the psychology of deception.
You've picked five from the article that we're looking at today. What was your reasons for choosing these five specific books? Like, how do you decide what's a good book on lying and a bad book on lying? Because there are a lot of bad books on the subject of lying.
There are a lot of it. I think before I write any show, I do a bunch of research. So I have about, I don't know, 30 some odd books online, and I kind of just page through them. And of course, in college, majoring in psychology, like there was a lot of books there, you know, Influence and Persuasion, which is Cialdini, which is not necessarily lying, but there's, you know, a lot of lying concepts in there. These were just like the best of the bunch. They were just the five that hit me the hardest.
Didn't Cialdini write The Art of Deception? He wrote a book on specifically on deception, I think, which is not as good as Influence, but it's still a pretty good read.
Yeah, I think it was one of those follow-up books to Influence, yeah.
And you've got a cross-section. You've got, I mean, like you mentioned Mark Twain, but we've got some self-help books, and some more kind of essay-based, more meandering stories, and then some hard psychology as well. So we got a very nice mix. Let's get straight into it. The Honest Truth About Dishonesty.
Dan Ariely, yeah. So this is kind of like that the only sort of pop psychology book that I think is great on deception, because it covers a wide spectrum of not only experiments done on deceit and lying, but also why we do it. And I think without all the fluff. And I think this book really, really captured me from cover to cover, because because the experiments were really interesting, but also Dan's motivation behind it was really interesting, because he talks a lot about perception in the first couple chapters, and I think that of course is important when you're talking about deception. I got to meet Dan at the Games for Change Festival in New York City, which was this really great festival where game designers and experienced designers come together and, you know, showcase their experiments and games to hopefully elicit change in the world. And he was doing this thing called the Truth Box, where you'd step inside and make a confession. And so I thought that was really clever. So I got to meet with him and chat with him a little bit about that. And he's just like such a nice guy. and so passionate about psychology of lying. And I think it's really passionate about everything, but particularly on this subject, he was really enthralled. He really captured me. So yeah.
So how did the truth box work? How did that actually work? Like as a game?
It wasn't necessarily a game. It was more of like a social experiment.
Just, I have an immediate visceral reaction to social experiment now. I just automatically think of you, because there's now, that's the thing that people, when you want to post a prank video on YouTube, You don't call it a prank. You call it a social experiment.
Yeah, I mean, I think social experiment is great because for sort of general audiences, because they love to see, you know, things performed on their fellow passerby. So
yeah,
I think that's the term has stuck, right?
Yeah.
But this, I think, in its most pure title, it is definitely a social experiment. It was a way, a social experiment in the way that there was research drawn from it, right? People of all races and ethnicities would get into the box and tell a truth, tell a confession. And I think that's really important, you know, to you know, talk about that.
And you actually told a story yourself in the box. You climbed in and told your own personal truth.
I did. They actually, I was doing Charlatan, my show at the time. And, I essentially just did a monologue from that, which is derived from truth. Cause they put the whole thing up on their website afterwards. And I think mine was like one of the first clips that went up, and it was like, I forget what, it was something like, I tell people my favorite song is a Frank Sinatra song, but it's actually Justin Timberlake, "Cry Me a River." but there was more to it, and then I think they just used that part, and it was slightly embarrassing.
Oh yeah, you got edited. Yeah. Do you find as someone who performs in front of the general public that when it comes, because we got this trend now for storytelling, and the idea of telling these sort of true stories. And I talk to a lot of comedians and magicians and storytellers and I don't know, burlesque artists, whoever, who do these kind of nights where the idea is you're revealing some sort of truth. And when you talk to them afterwards, there's always a little coda where they go, well, I actually combined two stories there, or it didn't actually happen to me, it happened to a friend of mine. And do you find that as a performer that you're kind of tempted to maybe change your true story just a little bit in order to make it more theatrical, or to maybe to get to the emotional center of the story, you might just change the facts?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, that's the best kind of fiction, right? That's the best kind of lie too, is one that uses parts of the truth. And I think a lot of ways why we do that is because we really want to make it sound sincere, right? Mm. So like if I'm telling a story, even to friends, I think we all do this, is if I'm telling a story and there's a couple of things that are true, right? But I really want to embellish, and I really want to suck every ounce out of the story. Like I will stretch the truth a little bit. And that's just our innate desire to tell great stories.
Yeah. Right?
And that's why it's actually become so hard to tell the truth, the exact story that has happened. You know, and part of it is also that our memories change and we can't quite remember every particular detail. So we start to fill in the gaps.
You know? Yeah. And there's that idea that every time you tell a story, your neural pathways get strengthened just a little bit in the direction of not what actually happened, but in the direction of the story you're telling. So the story evolves and changes, and you get convinced that you what you're saying is true after saying it for so many times. You know, like Brian Williams, who claimed that he'd come under fire when reporting in the Middle East when it never happened at all, and he just claimed it was because he told the story so many times it had become true. Yeah. What do you think that? Sorry, go on.
I was going to say we love to chastise people for that too, but the truth is that we do it all the time, right? We do it in every single day, and I think we like to kind of put these people on a pedestal because we like to feel better about ourselves.
Yeah. You know? What about though? Because there is a point at which it stops being, well, he was just telling a good story, and starts being deceptive and harmful. The case of Mike Daisy, who did a one-man show on an off-Broadway one-man show called, I think it was called Mr. Daisy Goes to the Apple Factory, and it was like an hour of him telling stories about going to see how iPads are made. And he told her these horrible stories about armed guards and, you know, child workers and all sorts of things. And then This American Life covered it and as a news story. And then it was later revealed that he'd made up large chunks of the story. And then there's like a, This American Life had to do a follow-up, both retracting, but then also figuring out what was true and what was not. And there's an extraordinary story where Mike Daisy basically stands by his piece of theatre where he told these, you know, lies to the audience who completely believed what he was saying was true, stood by it as a piece of theatre while apologising for what he said in the interview because he felt that that was deceptive in the context of journalism. So to him, he managed to justify one while also saying that the other was you know, obviously worth apologising for. So, I mean, clearly context plays a big role.
Of course. Did he say in the interview that, that these were all true stories?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he says in the show and in the interview, he tells them as true stories. And so This American Life did a big expose on the factory in Sichuan. I forgot the name of the factory. And then the factory sort of denied it. And it was a back and forth. And then some journalists actually went to the factory and looked and could see there are no guards, there are no children here. And he admitted that he'd made up big chunks of the story. So it was that weird, that, I guess it's that idea of like, you know, as a performer, as whether you're a magician or an actor or a comedian, if you tell the audience that this is a true story, do you think they have a right to hear a true story? Or do you think it's okay to then lead them down the garden path a little?
I think, in a theatrical context, you and the audience sign this theatrical contract where you come in and whatever you see is now the show, right? And that show can be absolutely derived from truth, right? We can be telling true stories, and that could be absolutely entertaining. But I think also what makes great mentalism and great magic performances is that there are parts of the truth in there, right? That's why we have those false explanations. That's why we sort of lead people down a particular path where we can get them to not think about the actual methods used, right? And I think that those layers of deception are great, both in magic and in fiction or just general storytelling. But I think, as soon as you bring it out of that context, I mean, for me, it ends at the theater, right? If somebody, like if right now we're working on a seance show, like an actual, a type of set derived from a seance. And the idea is that there are, you know, people who can talk to the dead. Now, if people ask me outside of that arena, can you or the actors talk to the dead? I'm going to say no. But as soon as you say yes, I think then that's when you start to run into problems, right?
Yeah, sure. Fair enough. Speaking of controversial figures, Sam Harris is also on your list of books. His essay, Lying. He's a fascinating guy, Sam Harris. He's definitely one of these new outspoken academics who are happy to go onto news programs and shout their opinions alongside the pundits. And are you a fan of Sam Harris in general?
I am, yeah. I saw him talk at the Rubin Museum and not on this book, but on his Waking Up book. And it was really great. I mean, he's thankfully there's somebody of, you know, thankfully there's an intellectual speaking about meditation. And that was what I really appreciated, that he wasn't afraid to not only talk about it, but write a book on the benefits of meditating. Which is great, but to bring it back to actual lying, this is just like a short book on sort of building off of what Mark Twain talks about, which is the sort of judicious lying, right? Is lying to preserve relationships, but where there's no evil intent. It's just sort of, we have to learn how to lie to each other in sort of a graceful way. And that's what I really appreciate about this particular book.
Yeah, that's what I enjoyed as well, is that books online either come across as, you know, in the past they've said lying is bad, don't lie, and here are the moral and religious reasons why you shouldn't. Or they say, look, people lie, it's not the best thing in the world to do, but they do it because, you know, they have some sort of human flaw, or they're doing it for good reasons. They don't want to hurt people. But his his point of view is that, well, if we are going to lie, and there is a value in lying, and one we should learn how to master if we are going to do it. So I guess learn how to lie properly. Do you think that there's the danger there, I guess, if we then say as a society, yeah, it's totally fine to lie, it's totally fine to deceive people in the right circumstances, that it gives people carte blanche to go out and deceive whenever they want and say, well, it's all moral relativism, and it's giving people permission to be bad people?
I don't think so. I think what he's talking about is giving permission to forgive yourself a little, right? I think part of feeling like part of knowing that you lie all the time is sort of the guilt, right? Is the guilt of feeling like, oh, that's terrible. I should be completely honest with someone. But when he talks about judicious lying, same with Mark Twain, is like the whole point is to keep up our self-esteem, right? For ourselves, but also for others. I mean, he doesn't talk about lying in a sense with evil intent. I think that's sort of the difference, right? Is when lying has such a bad connotation, right? It's like, oh, you're a liar. That's terrible. You know, like, yeah. I think what he's trying to do is say, look, we all do it. We're all liars. And I think that's okay. It's differentiating between the lying that I think this book is trying to break apart. You know, he's trying to explain the difference, and I think that's important.
So then moving on, Paul Ekman is, I think, the world's leading expert on lying. I can't think of anyone who knows more on the subject, particularly from a psychological and neurological point of view. And his book, Unmasking the Face, has made your list. He's written a lot of books, though. Why this one in particular?
This one in particular is just kind of a great, something I wanted to do with this list is kind of put out introductory books, like nothing that's going to be really deep down the rabbit hole, nothing that's going to be too scholarly, but something that's really accessible. And I think it was either between this or Telling Lies, and I love both those books, but Unmasking the Face is great because you have all of the, you have all the photographs of the examples. And then he also, you know, he spins it in such a way that that I think it humanizes it, right? I mean, he really just, of course, it's very scientific, and you can kind of get lost in the actual research, and it's a little dense at parts. But in general, when you look through, like the actual lying, the actual not the lying parts, but the facial expressions, what you see is other humans making faces that we make all the time, that everyone else makes all the time. And I think that's what I really enjoyed about the book. And I occasionally will flip through it. And, you know, this is the book that every magician and mentalist kind of goes, oh yeah, your eyebrow is going up, so it's a red card. You know?
Oh yeah. That I used to do that myself as a performer. I'd come up, you know, you're looking up and to the left, or you drew a Q with the tail over the right or left. Oh, look, I've mentioned this on the podcast before. And so went, well, that's the kind of thing where even though it is in a show, it isn't a performance. There are people who go away and totally believe that is 100% how, you know, if someone looks up and to the left or whatever it is, they must be lying. Sure. And went, well, maybe that's something that I would, that's an idea that I'd rather not get across. Because that's one of the things that, I mean, the promise of all of his work, Paul Ekman's work, is that he says, is that learn how to tell if people are lying or telling the truth. And his, everything that he does, he's always undercut with the very clear, either, you know, implicitly and stated or implied concept that there is no Pinocchio's nose. There is no surefire way to tell if someone is telling the truth or lying. You know, you will never be 100% correct. All you can really do is get hints that will point you in the right direction. And from there, you can, you know, maybe ascertain the truth. One thing we should say about Paul Ekman is that he is the inspiration for the TV show Lie to Me. So he's like has a fictional character based on him. The TV show then spreads some of the myths about lying and lie detection that he himself probably wouldn't spread. So it's that, again, it's that interesting cross between fact and fiction.
That's what makes that. I mean, if that show was just all facts, I mean, I imagine, based on the research, you couldn't have some of the scenarios that he was in, you know. So, you know, you gotta stretch the truth a little bit.
Just a little. Just a little.
I do a bit in my show that is essentially just kind of a standard mentalism, you know, sneak thief bit. But it's based around the concept of Ekman. But I make sure to never actually say that this is what I'm doing. I just talk about Paul Ekman, and then I do this thing with a magnifying glass, kind of holding it up to each person's face as a funny bit, and then I'm able to discern they're lying. And every time somebody comes up to me afterwards and go, "I just can't believe that you use micro expressions. It's so unbelievable." And I'm just like, "Yeah,
it is." This is the thing. This is one of the things. It is so satisfying to do that, is to get people to believe something that isn't true. I think that's. I think it's why people become con artists. A lot of the time, yeah. It is so satisfying to create something out of nothing. Yeah. I'm not a big fan. I was going to say, speaking of turning something into nothing, Ryan Holiday, because I'm not a fan of Mr. Holiday, but you've included him on your list with "Trust Me, I'm Lying: Confessions of a Media Manipulator," because he comes from the Robert Greene 48 Laws of Power, How to Be a Jerk, you know, and Get Ahead. World. He's someone who has, rather than being an academic, like the rest of the people on the list, or at the very least offering an outside opinion, he's someone who said, "I'm full of it, and I've made a living being a liar and a deceiver, and here is how I did it," with a certain amount of pride.
Sure. And I think that's a good perspective to have, right? I think it, look, I have read other books by Ryan. I don't love I'm in the same camp as you. I don't really like his other books. But this one for me, I think this was actually one of his first, or the first book. Maybe his second book. But I just couldn't put it down, because it was amazing the amount of deception that goes into manipulating the media. And I think that's an important perspective to have. And you're totally right. He is a complete bullshit artist. Sorry, there's a siren outside of my apartment. That sound happens every time I lie. Okay, it's all over. So I think that's an important perspective to have, is his. And yes, I totally agree. I think he's a complete bullshit artist. But hey, all power to him. I mean, he's made a great success out of it. And he's done what he does, what he gets paid for other people, for himself. And I think that's a really great, I think it's a really great thing. So,
yeah, I guess that's the thing. Like, you see it a lot, is the idea of the reformed con artist or the reformed criminal, or, you know, he's neither of those things specifically. He's a bullshit artist saying, excuse me, "I'm going to reveal all of the secrets of this world to you. Because, you know, I want to pull back the curtain." But really what they're doing is just finding another way to profit from their skills. I mean, he presents himself as a sort of pseudo motivational speaker. You know, the idea is you can learn from him, you know, in some way, much like these sort of the pickup artist community that began with The Game, that was, you know, the book The Game was almost like an expose of this world, and then became propagating the world and its ideas. And he sort of does the same thing, surely, of sort of saying, "Look, here are the terrible things I've done, and here are how you can do them as well." So he's not really exposing the world so much as teaching people how to be a part of it. Isn't it? I mean, do you think that's fair?
I think that's fair. But I also say the important thing about this book for me was because. Con artists have this kind of cliche, stereotypical image around them, which is like a guy in an overcoat who's smoking a cigarette and slyly conning you out of money. You know, we have this archetype in our minds for that. I think the important thing about this book is to realize that, you know, the new con artists are actually faceless. You know, they're the people on the internet who are using algorithms to control your behaviors, who are lying to the media, who are exploiting blogs. I mean, that this is kind of a this is an important new discussion, and I think, look, his book is not all fluff. I think some of it There are some really great points and also just some really great stories in there about how he's gone about and done this, is, you know, creating fake email accounts and submitting to Jezebel or to BuzzFeed and to really getting people's careers off the ground. I mean, that's kind of impressive. And the fact that that is how things are run is also a bit scary. But I do align with you in saying that, like, it's, I think the rest of his, I think this was definitely his, you know, standout book, so far anyway.
We'll see. until he does an exposé of the business of being someone who exposes things and gives away all the secrets on how to do that. Speaking of people who are masters of media manipulation, that brings us finally to number one on the list, Mark Twain on the Decay of the Art of Lying. He, in his lifetime, perpetrated multiple hoaxes and grand lies that he tricked the general public into believing. And his fiction is obviously, you know, the beautiful. He has a great saying about Australia, which is the history of Australia. Sounds like the most beautiful lies, which I always love. So he was a man who spent a lot of time thinking about deception. What is the core idea of this book?
Yeah, I mean, the core idea is the thing that we've been talking about, which is, you know, he brings to light the fact that there is no truth teller, right? He says, I think, in the book, like, a habitual truth teller is an impossible creature, right? Or something along those lines. But like, I mean, that's the truth. I mean, we do lie, maybe not to everyone every day, but definitely to ourselves, as a survival instinct. You know, this is something that is a part of our nature. In my show, I talked about the hog-nosed snake and how it would start to convulse when a predator would approach, and flip over and start vomiting blood and eventually die, right? Until the predator would think it was diseased and walk away. And then the hognose snake would flip back over and slither away to safety. And it's not a miracle. It's a defense mechanism, right? So he really talks about lying as if it were a defense mechanism. And in the blog post I wrote, you know, a quote from it, which I think is sort of the standout quote, which I'll just read of the book, is, or of the essay. Lying is a sweet and loving art and should be cultivated. The highest perfection of politeness is only a beautiful edifice built from the base to the dome of graceful and gilded forms of charitable and unselfish lying. And that really paints lying in a different picture, doesn't it? I mean, it's not this evil thing anymore. It's actually this kind of beautiful art that I think has been lost in a lot of ways. That's sort of the crux of the book or of the essay.
Do you think that if Twain was alive today, he would be the Ryan Holiday of his I'll start that again. Do you think if Mark Twain was alive today, he would be a Ryan Holiday type, that he would be manipulating blogs and Twitter feeds with fake accounts and emails?
No, I think he wouldn't be that. I mean, I like to think that he would be a storyteller, but not for not straight away for social change. You know, I think what Ryan's trying to do is be the voice of almost like a motivational speaker, like you were saying before, like be somebody that people look up to and be like, yes, this guy is really smart. He's telling a story, but he's telling it for kind of self reasons. I think Mark Twain would tell a story, but in a really unique way, almost along the lines of, like, I don't know, I want to say like immersive theater, or, you know, really kind of telling a story that, touches us on a different level. I don't think he would be policing lying in any way, you know.
So you reckon he might be a mind reader and mentalist living in Brooklyn?
that would be wonderful. Yeah. Yeah,
I love the idea of Mark Twain alive today doing immersive theater, like some kind of doing puzzle rooms and, you know, deconstructing burlesque. And I think that'd be brilliant. I'd love to see that.
Way better than the stuff that's out there right now.
But, yeah, probably.
But telling telling a really immersive story, a story that does that that is not bound to one medium. I think that's what he would be, you know.
Do you have any big shows coming up?
I do a monthly show at this place called Union Hall in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. It's called Mind Reader, and that'll be May 6th. And then hopefully another off-Broadway show at the end of August. That'll be announced hopefully next month if all goes to plan, fingers crossed.
Excellent. And finally, are you reading any good books online at the moment?
Oh, man, I'm always interested in deception and the psychology of it. I think a book I went back to recently was that didn't make the list was Lies, Lies, Lies by Ford. Oh, what is his name? Can't think of it, remember his first name, but Ford is the last name. And that's a really great, really great book. It's a little dense to get through, but it's really, really cool. But yeah, right now I'm just reading storytelling books and writing books and just how to write a better story, how to write a better lie, if you will.
This has been Scammapalooza. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au.